Disasters, by their very nature, are hard to predict. Pandemics, earthquakes, wildfires, financial crises, and wars are not normally distributed. There is no cycle of history to help us anticipate the next catastrophe. But when disaster strikes, we ought to be better prepared than the Romans were when Vesuvius erupted, or medieval Italians when the Black Death struck. We do have science on our side, after all, right? Well, yet in the face of the COVID-19 pandemic, the responses of a number of developed countries, including the United States of America, were badly bungled. Why? Well, in the new book, Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe, New York Times bestselling author Neil Ferguson sets the great crises of 2020 in broad historical perspective. It explores why, in the face of a catastrophe, some societies fall apart and others hold together, while a few emerge stronger. Again, the name of the book is Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. It's a pleasure to welcome Neil Ferguson to the roundtable this morning. Neil, thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be with you, Joe.
Great pleasure. I am an admirer of your work, and this book is no exception to that. Quite a read. What brought you to the subject? Was it something you were working on prior to COVID, or was it really the catalyst?
It was certainly something I was working on before the pandemic struck, and it's a general history of disaster, which I'd been interested in because such a book didn't exist, and I had gone on a science fiction reading binge, which may surprise your listeners, but I'd come to the conclusion that I'd actually been reading too much history and was thinking maybe too much in terms of past worlds. So I thought I need to write about the history of the future, because we are very good as humans imagining future disasters. That's actually part of what makes science fiction such a rich genre. So I was kind of trying to persuade my editor in New York that I should write a history of future disaster, because I felt as if it would help me think about the scenarios that we have to grapple with. So before I could even get past the first draft, I'd kind of written a draft, along came a real disaster, and I realized that the opportunity had finally presented itself to formulate a kind of general theory of disaster and try to help contextualize what was unfolding before our very eyes last year. So that was the genesis of the book.
Once you look at this, I mean, it really does set it up to be the story of how we got to where we are, though, right?
Oh, yeah, because I think there are lots of odd things that have happened in the last 16 months which you wouldn't have predicted in 2019. On paper, for example, the United States was very well prepared for a pandemic. There was a kind of global ranking that put the U.S. at the top, and the U.K. was also very highly ranked, and that certainly turned out not to be true. And so we need to try to work out what exactly went wrong, because I can promise you more disasters are coming. The human history is one damn disaster after another, and you never can predict what's going to be next. That's an important theme of the book, by the way, that disasters just aren't predictable. And you're kidding yourself if you think you can attach a probability to the next massive earthquake in California. That's just not life. We have to live with this uncertainty and be ready for a wide variety of disasters. So I think we need to decide what exactly went wrong last year. And I'm worried that the simple answer is very seductive. And the simple answer is that the president was incompetent, and if we'd had a better president, we'd be fine. And I've heard the same argument in Britain being made about Prime Minister Boris Johnson. I've heard it made in Brazil about Jair Bolsonaro. I've heard it now made in India about Narendra Modi. And I say in the book, yeah, I mean, Donald Trump made dozens of mistakes, and some of them were very clearly harmful in their consequences. But I think if we asked the counterfactual question, what if Joe Biden had got elected somehow a year early, would it all have been fine, and would we have had no excess mortality in the United States? I don't think that's plausible. And the reason I don't think it's plausible is not to defend Trump. It's to recognize that the point of failure in a disaster is not exclusively at the top. And Ron Klain, Biden's chief of staff, had acknowledged this back in 2019, talking about the swine flu pandemic of 2009, which you may remember. The swine flu pandemic didn't kill that many people, but it was very infectious. A lot of people got that influenza, and it was just luck that it wasn't as lethal as COVID. And Ron Klain acknowledged, and I, you know, salute his candor, that if that had been as bad as COVID, the Obama administration would have had a real problem on its hands. So we need to recognize that there's something in our public health system, maybe something in the federal government generally, that is not very good at disaster management. And let's face it, it's not like this is the first disaster we've managed badly. I don't think we managed 9/11 brilliantly. I don't think we managed Katrina brilliantly. I think we managed the financial crisis pretty badly. And so there's a pattern here of disasters that we ought to be prepared for somehow catching us out and leading to all kinds of, at least partly, avoidable errors.
So is it seems that the first thing that we want to do once we realize that there's a problem is find who to blame for it. Is that constructive? I mean, should we spend a lot of time doing that? And is that second part of that question? And is that part of getting to the bottom of it and figuring out what went wrong?
Well, remember, figuring out who's to blame or who's responsible is part of what historians do. We usually do it at great distance, but there's no reason not to try to apply these skills to relatively recent events, events that aren't even over in the sense that this pandemic is far from over. And I think if you apply the historical skills, you realize that it's too simple to say the fault entirely lies with the person at the top. And we all know, with respect to smaller disasters, that's not true. I mean, I don't just talk about big disasters. I talk about smaller ones, which killed relatively few people. But whether it's the Titanic, which is a famous disaster, one of the biggest shipping disasters, or the Space Shuttle Challenger, which only killed its crew of seven when it blew up, there's still an initial temptation to pin it on somebody at the top. I mean, a lot of people blame the Titanic on the chief executive, the owner of the shipping line. There was an impulse to try to pin the Challenger disaster on Ronald Reagan, who was president at the time. And that's kind of where we go. That's our default setting. And maybe that's because it's true that responsibility ultimately lies at the top, as Harry Truman said, the buck stops here. But I think it's not the case that the causation stems necessarily from the top. Often, it's somewhere in the middle of the chain of command that the disaster actually has its origin, its point of failure. That was the case with the Challenger. Richard Feynman, the great Caltech physicist, showed that what happened there was that the middle management people at NASA deliberately understated the risk of an explosion from a fuel leakage. The engineers knew that it was like a 1% chance, but the bureaucrats turned that into 1 in 100,000. And I remember thinking when I was reading that, that's the kind of familiar pattern where the real point of failure is not actually necessarily at the top. It's somewhere down the chain of command. I think there were some significant failures further down the chain of command in 2020 that we need to recognize, not to exonerate Trump. I think he did a terrible job, just to be clear. But to clarify what went wrong so that we don't make the same set of mistakes when the next disaster strikes.
So, given that this is a global problem, I mean, you mentioned that if you know, you can't just blame Trump, you can look at leaders all across the world, all around the world, and say that they had a hand in what happened when it comes to COVID. So when it comes to making things better and to understanding where we are now and all of what you said earlier about, you know, the failure and being able to figure out what's going to happen down the line, how do we realize what the consequences were so we can at least address those concerns and try to be a little bit better in saving people's lives when the next shoe drops?
I think the key is to look at the countries that got it right and try to learn from them, because there were countries that did this in a very impressive way. I'm thinking of Taiwan and South Korea in particular. I'd also say Israel did a pretty good job, though it had one big spike of infections and illness last year. But if you look at Taiwan, here's what they did. They very quickly ramped up testing. As soon as there was even the glimmer of a suspicion that this thing had human-to-human transmission, they didn't wait for the Chinese government to acknowledge that. They just went ahead. They had a contact tracing app that allowed them to identify who an infected person had been in touch with. And then they had a pretty effective system of isolating people who were infected or suspected of being infected. And that is why, in Taiwan, since last year, a grand total of 12 people died of COVID. 12, not 12,000, but just 12. Whereas, of course, we've now passed the 500,000 mark. So let's look at the Taiwanese and ask what they did right. Because I think we spent a lot of time looking at the other China. We looked at the People's Republic of China back in March after we'd failed to do all the things I just described Taiwan did. We kind of went from complacency to panic and did lockdowns, which was essentially a Chinese model. That's what the People's Republic of China did starting in late January. And in mid-March, many parts of the Western world decided that's the only way we can deal with this. But I think we need to recognize that there was a much smarter way of doing it, and we could have had that if we'd only been quicker with testing, with contact tracing, and then with, you know, really efficiently keeping infected people away from vulnerable people. Because unlike most pandemics in history, this is a very unusual pandemic. Most pandemics in history kill the very young as well as the very old. And some pandemics kill people in the prime of life. That was true of both of the great influenza pandemics of the 20th century. So we need to learn from governments that were smart. And I think what we need to learn is not just that they learnt the lesson of SARS and MERS, which I think is true, but it's not the only story. I think we need to learn the benefits of being generally paranoid rather than meticulously prepared for the wrong disaster. What's really striking about Taiwan and South Korea and Israel is that they live in hostile environments. Their neighbors are really very hostile indeed in some cases. And therefore, they have a generally high level of paranoia. And that means that whatever form the attack takes, if you're Taiwanese, you have to prepare yourself for an invasion, or you have to prepare for some kind of cyber attack, or you have to prepare for a hostile pathogen. Whatever form it takes, they're really quick. And it's that speed of response that is crucial. As I said, we can't predict the next disaster. There's just no way of doing that. But what we can do is be quick on the draw when it starts. And that's what we really failed to do. And it drove me crazy. I was in Washington in February when it was absolutely clear that we were going to be slammed. There was no way the virus was not in every state by that point. And I could not believe how many people in Washington were still in denial about this stark reality. And that was February, long after we had missed the chance to contain the spread.
All right, so let's focus on that. Neil Ferguson is our guest. The new book is Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. So what does lead some people to say, all right, we are going to adapt and look at this rationally and try to figure out what's happening with this new threat? And others just sort of sit back and say, oh, well, let's see what happens. And others go in complete denial. How much of that is just human nature, and which seems disturbing considering that there are lives at stake?
Well, human nature is definitely not on our side when it comes to thinking about disasters. We have so many cognitive biases that lead us to draw wrong inferences that it would take up the rest of the show to list them all. But let's just say that when we're confronted with disaster, we struggle. We struggle to attach any real probabilities to the disaster scenario, and we struggle to process the new data as of course, it flows in. And I think that that's part of the problem. We're just not great at this. In fact, we often are thrown into two states of mind by the coming of a disaster. State one is denial. This is not happening. It's just the seasonal flu. What is everybody talking about? And the other is extreme paralysis, kind of hysterical terror, which is debilitating in a different way. The problem at the level of public policy is that the public is reacting in these ways, and you have to somehow arrive at a persuasive and rational policy. Meanwhile, the internet is supplying any number of conspiracy theories about the virus, about the potential remedies for it, about vaccines. So that makes it even harder. I think one of the things that I'm really struck by in the successful countries is the way they use technology to empower citizens. And Audrey Tang is one of the heroes of my book, a fascinating person, a transgender minister for technology in Taiwan, who for years has argued that the key is to use the technology to empower citizens and not the government, not the state. And that's why contact tracing in Taiwan was a success. People felt enough trust in the government to use a contact tracing app. And that, I think, is what we need to try to figure out so that we don't just leave technology, so to speak, lying on the sidelines unused to contend with an emergency. But you're right to say that it's difficult. And if the public health authorities miscommunicate, which they clearly did a number of times, then trust is eroded. We have a big problem in the US that we didn't used to have. In the 1950s, public health issues were not really partisan. Now they are. And everything became a partisan issue last year. Mask wearing, obviously, but also, you know, whether there were therapies that worked. Hydroxychloroquine, remember all that?
Yes.
And then vaccines in turn. And so we've very unwittingly and foolishly politicized things that ought not to be partisan issues. And that's something that one certainly doesn't see in a country like Taiwan or Korea. I don't think this is cultural, by the way, because people have often said to me, oh, well, this is because there's a big difference between American individualism and Asian collectivism. I think that's complete rubbish. Actually, we ended up having our civil liberties much more restricted than the Taiwanese because we ended up in many states being shut in our homes. And clearly, a contact tracing app is a less significant restriction on your liberties than house arrest, which is what we were kind of subjected to, and certainly in California. So I think we need to ask ourselves some hard questions about how we're going to deal with the next disaster when it strikes, because I dread to see this whole process repeating itself, in which we are prepared on paper, have lots of preparedness plans, and then they unravel when the disaster actually strikes.
I want to go back to something that you just said and clarify that and go in a little bit more in a bit more detail if we can. And that is, does catastrophe have to be political? I mean, I know it is now, and it seems that we have trouble getting away from that. But does it have to be?
I don't think it does. And I don't think it does in America, because if one looks at the 1957-58 pandemic, which, as I think I said before, was as bad globally as COVID has been, not as bad in the US. But partly, I think it was not as bad because we handled it a lot better. And in the 1950s, of course, there were plenty of political differences between Democrats and Republicans. But on the issue of vaccination, there was none. In fact, Americans in the 1950s were rather proud of the fact that the U.S. led the world in vaccination, that the U.S. was very good at developing new vaccines and then manufacturing them and deploying them. So it seems very, very regrettable that we've allowed the politicization along partisan lines of something like vaccination. And this was a predictable outcome because, and I remember writing about this in my last book, The Square and the Tower, in 2018, anti-vaccination as an online network was already well established before 2020. And it was already concerning people who work on the internet, like my colleague at Stanford, René D'Arresta, who delved into this partly out of her own experience of encountering strong anti-vax activism when she moved to San Francisco. So I think this is a very good illustration of how things have changed in America. And we do have to try and ask ourselves if everything belongs in the domain of party politics. My own view is that it does not, but we've become incurably addicted to a kind of polarization and partisan division on every issue. And I dread to think what will happen if we start turning earthquake preparedness into a partisan issue in the West Coast, just to give you one example, or hurricane preparedness on the East Coast. I mean, it can't possibly be the case that there's a Republican hurricane and a Democratic hurricane. They're just hurricanes, and the same goes for earthquakes. But, you know, it's got to that point. And I think, again, this is not something that's in our DNA as a nation. We did not used to deal with issues in quite this way. I think the internet has made that worse. I think we failed to fix the internet as a problem, because after the 2016 election, there clearly was a problem, and we just decided not to do that much about it. And I think we've paid a price for that this year.
And the other thing that we're, and this goes back to what we were talking about before, but we also politicize it because we're trying to find the person to blame, right? And so it can't be our side, it's got to be their side.
Right. And yet, of course, there were Democrats who failed as badly as the president. There were governors who I'll not name names, but it's fairly obvious that the governors of New York and California did not do brilliantly. And I think that it illustrates the point that in a disaster, I mean, the virus doesn't care about your party allegiance, let's put it that way, and it doesn't care whether you're a blue state or a red state. So I think one of the things I want to try and communicate in Doom is that disaster is not a partisan issue. And we need to try to think a little bit more clearly about problems that lie ahead of us, whether they're climate related or cyber attacks or things that we don't think at all about, like imagine a sudden change in sunspot activity or a massive increase in volcanic activity of the sort that we haven't seen in 200 years. There hasn't been a really big volcanic eruption on this planet since 1815. All the volcanoes since then have been kind of small. But if you look back over 1,000 years, one of the striking features of the Earth's climate history is that periodically there's massive volcanic activity, late 1100s, late 1200s, then some major activity culminating in 1815. And that has a huge impact globally on climate. We've forgotten about that because it just hasn't happened in so long. So my sense is that we need to kind of take a deep breath and say, yeah, there are some things that clearly do belong in the realm of party politics, but there are other things which are such profound existential threats to us that we ought to be able to arrive at a consensus on how best to deal with them. And I think that's one of the lessons that we need to learn from the very successful experience of Taiwan and South Korea in the past 15 or 16 months.
I realize that we're getting into some of the grains of sand, but as we wrap up together, I mean, isn't it, if we can figure out that, oh, it's a good idea to get vaccinated so other people don't get sick, or it's a good idea to wear a mask so I don't give this to somebody else. If we can't agree on that, then those seem to be like the basic tenets that then it's hard to go beyond that.
I think one of the things that I'm struck by is that we've got to make our communications, our public health policy sane for it to be credible. And a very good illustration of how we went wrong was the failure to see that this thing really wasn't transmitted, was not spread outdoors. And that was obvious a year ago, because the data coming out of China showed that there was almost no outdoor spread. And in fact, it was spread indoors in super spreader events, where people were in large crowds indoors yelling, whether it was in busy bars and restaurants or cruise ships, whatever. We knew all that a year ago. So what on earth were they thinking here in California, for example, when they closed the public parks and the beaches as if to make the house arrest experience even more miserable for people? And it's only just the other day that we're getting the admission from CDC that actually there really wasn't much. There really wasn't much outdoor transmission. Actually, there was hardly any. So even now, the CDC is still not communicating in a credible way. Even the New York Times is correcting the CDC for making it seem like there's outdoor risk. I mean, here in California, on the Stanford campus, people are wandering around outdoors, even jogging with masks on. It's crazy. I don't know what they think they're doing. There's actually evidence to suggest that if you're fully vaccinated, you might be doing some good by breathing over people because you're probably breathing antibodies out. So I think, looking back, that a layman, and I'm a layman, I'm not an epidemiologist or a virologist, right, who was reading the literature that was coming out of the places that were initially hit, could see clearly that we were making major blunders in public health policy that were calculated to alienate people, or at least had the effect of alienating them. And that's something that we need to learn from. Messaging has to be credible, and it has to be consistent. You can't say one day, no masks, which they did to try and preserve the numbers of masks for healthcare professionals, and then say, actually, three masks. This just destroys credibility. So it's not only that we were slow in our response, but I think our communications from our public health bureaucracy were extraordinarily confusing and alienating, and that must not happen again. And again, that shouldn't belong in the realm of party politics. That is just a matter of good communications. If you were a company thinking about your consumers, Neil, you would not have communicated this way.
We are out of time, but I thank you so much for being with us. The name of the book is Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe.